What was it like to be a part of the events that shaped our world? This is the show that shares those stories from the people who were there. This is Eyewitness History. Where were you on September 11th, 2001? For those of us old enough to remember, that is a question we can answer clearly and quickly. All of us remember exactly where we were when we heard the news that a plane had flown into one of the buildings that is the World Trade Center. And at the time, we didn't know exactly what that was. Was it an accident? Was it something that was done intentionally? And then as the day unfolded, of course, we knew exactly what it was. And we all remember exactly where we were when we received the news. I was in the Marine Corps. I was on actually the rifle range. We were doing some training when all the training stopped. Someone came on the loudspeaker and told us exactly what had happened. And again, that brought with it some confusion and a lot of questions. But all of us, again, who are old enough to remember that and who lived through that time know that it changed so much. It changed a lot in our country. It changed things around the world. For those that were in the military at the time or who would be in the military in the 20 years following that day, it changed our lives. But there were a lot of people who responded to exactly what happened that day. They didn't wait to find out. They didn't wait to see how things would unfold. They responded to the tragedy regardless of what had caused it. A lot of unanswered questions, a lot of question marks, but there were people, first responders, volunteers who were in the area, people from around the world that came to what we now call Ground Zero and did everything they could to help. What would it have been like to be there, working through the rubble, trying to find those who were trapped, those who couldn't get out and needed help, finding their way to safety? What would it be like to have been there at Ground Zero on those days following the tragedy that is 9/11. My guest today is Dusty Shellhammer. Dusty is a friend of mine. We've been friends for a number of years. And Dusty has such a fascinating life. We're going to talk about that a little bit in this interview. But he has done a number of things. He's an interesting person, a great friend of mine, in part because of just how interesting he is and how passionate he is about the things that he does. But he has been a first responder literally since the time he was old enough to be a first responder. Started as a police officer, became a firefighter, got involved in emergency rescue, served on the national response team, and he doesn't tell this story in this interview, but is what would be called a plank holder for Homeland Security. He was part of the team that became Homeland Security and the response team connected to that. Served in a number of areas. He was a part of the response to Oklahoma City bombing. He was a part of the response to Katrina, Hurricane Katrina. Both fascinating stories. But probably the biggest response that he was a part of, and those are huge, but the biggest response that he was a part of was that of 9/11. He was called into action on September 11th. And made his way with his team to Ground Zero, and they got there the next day, literally hours after this had happened. He was there on September 12th, spent over 90 days there, part of the rescue effort and all that went on there. And man, I've heard him tell this story so many times. I wanted to share it with you. And I wanted to share it with you in part because it's interesting, it's fascinating. For those of us, again, that can remember what happened there, it's helpful to get that perspective of someone on the ground, someone who saw it kind of unfold, the rescue effort and all that went on there. But it's also a story that needs to be told so that we don't forget. It's easy for us to look at the world as it is today and just accept this as normal. But before September 11th, 2001, the world was a very different place. Travel was different. How we interacted with each other was different. How we interacted with other countries was different. How we thought about the world and how we thought about security and safety, all of those things were different. This is a different world because of what happened on that day. And this is a story that we need to make sure that we don't forget and make sure that generations coming up behind us will also remember. So I'm very grateful to have Dusty here to tell that story. I know this is a story that you are going to be interested in. It is interesting. It's really fascinating to get this firsthand account and view. This is a story that you are going to want to share with others, and I'm very excited to be able to share this with you. Without further ado, my interview with my friend and guest, Dusty Schellhammer.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Dusty, thanks for joining me, man. I am I'm super stoked for this conversation. We talked about all of this stuff like so many times. What I'm really excited about is sharing this part of your story with a lot of other people who don't know it. So thanks for coming on and taking some time to do this.
I appreciate you having me. It's definitely a unique story, something that was kind of thrust upon me.
Yeah,
that I really didn't prepare for, but as soon as I got into this line of work, who knew where the road was going to take us except for God himself, you know?
Yeah, I think anyone who was alive during 9/11 and all of the events around 9/11 certainly remembers that. And it's, you know, you ask the question, where were you when that happened? Everyone can put themselves in that place if they were old enough to remember that. And I think everyone has a unique perspective of what took place there. But for most people, you know, billions of people around the world, most people, our perspective is really formed by what we saw on the news, what we were told by, you know, reporting and whatever. But your experience is so different. That's what has been fascinating to me as I've heard you tell a lot of these stories and a lot of what you experience, because it puts a whole different view on it to me, kind of a human view, and really connects to the people that responded to that. So I want to talk about that, but talk about the work that you got into and why you got into. I mean, you've been a police officer and a firefighter. You've been involved in emergency response, I think probably since you were old enough to care about these things. Kind of talk about that, how you got into it, why you got into it, and the training that got you to the point where you got the call to respond to Ground Zero, to the Twin Towers.
Yeah, well, it just started out basically as when I was growing up, I decided I was going to be a police officer. My initials are DPS, so it's just natural that I was going to be a state trooper in the state of Texas, Department of Public Safety, you know, just where it was going to go. So I got out of high school, graduated, went to college, got my degree in criminal justice, got out, started being a police officer right away. Well, as I was being a police officer, even back then, it was kind of leaning towards negativity against police department and police officers. It wasn't near where we're at with the culture today, but there was still, you know, nobody really likes to see the cops come. Every time the cops show up, there's a problem. Somebody's mad. Something's gone wrong. So as I was early on in that career, of course, you work hand in hand, seen a lot of scenes with the firefighters, and I kind of got interested where I thought maybe I wanted to be a firefighter. So I was on night shift as a police department and would go to day fire academy.
Yeah.
So for a while there, I was just, of course, when you're young, 21 years old, time doesn't really matter. So I was just, you know, I'd get a couple hours sleep, down some more coffee, and hit the fire academy. And graduated from the fire academy and got on with the city of Big Spring as a firefighter. They ate it up real quick because in the fire service, at least in the state of Texas, fire marshals and fire investigators have to be police officers. Oh. So I already had that portion knocked out. So they were really, really happy to line me up as a firefighter, arson investigation and everything. I had all the police work ready. So we implemented that. I'm really big on, it's probably my ADHD. I don't know if that's self-diagnosed, by the way. I just can't sit still. I've got to be active and doing stuff. So when I became a firefighter, I immersed myself into the rescue world of the firefighting side of it. High angle rescue, rope rescue, jaws of life, vehicle extrication, building collapse, things like that, that really interest me. I wanted the technical part of the fire service, not just being a hose monkey and going and spraying water on hot stuff.
Yeah.
And that led me to a designated fire station in the city of Big Spring that did the rope rescue, jaws of life response and everything. So we got together and decided we were going to build a team for the state of Texas, and just kind of a rapid response team for the state of Texas to go travel around and help other cities when they have major disasters just within our own state. And as we were putting this together, Oklahoma City bombing happened.
Yeah.
And we bumped out to Oklahoma City bombing and did some work there and kind of got going in Oklahoma City, and things were going good, and they kind of saw what we were doing, and they decided, you know, we want to do this nationwide. And just me being in the right place at the right time got thrust to the top of that. We deployed out to what hurricane? Tropical Storm Allison in Houston. And my commander at the time was busy and didn't have a chance to make a meeting downtown at the mayor's office. And she asked me, hey, will you go to this meeting downtown and kind of be our representative for our team? And I took off and went down there. And in typical Dusty fashion, I went into the wrong meeting and sat down with the national management support team and proceeded to give my opinion on how things should be.
They just let you walk in, huh? I'm in the wrong place. They just let you sit down.
Yeah, pretty much. You just kind of, you know, everybody kind of overuses the term God's will. I guess this is kind of way.
Right.
And when the meeting was over, the head of that meeting, his name was Steve Caesar. We called him Sid. He kind of caught me aside and he goes, hey, who are you and who are you with?
And why are you here?
Basically. And he was like, man, I like kind of like the way you think. Why don't you come be with us? So I went back to my camp where we were staged and packed up all my gear and went over to the management support team, and now I was part of this new organization. He sent a letter up through Washington and said, Dusty now belongs to us, and here we go.
And that's what became Homeland Security. Is that right? That's kind of where that came from.
Yeah, and that didn't come about till after 9/11. 9/11 happened, and, of course, a lot of things in the world changed after that.
Yeah.
That's how basically I got started in on the federal side of the teams.
Yeah, that's crazy. Man, there's so much in your story, right? Like you just passed over Oklahoma City bombing. I mean, that's a whole other episode we can do at some point. You know, and I know this from your story later on. You were involved in Katrina and a lot of the aftermath, the triage of the people that were, you know, you were dealing with there. So that's a crazy thing. So a lot of nutty stuff, right? Like you have so many things in your adult life that one of those are more than most people. And you've experienced all of these because of where you were and the things that you were involved in. But 9/11 is something we're all invested in. And when that happened, a lot of Americans were asking, what can I do? And I don't think that was a question you had to ask, because when it happened, you were told this is what you need to do. And you guys loaded up and got there. So talk about watching that happen, knowing it happened, and then how does that response unfold? You're in Texas. The next day you're in New York. How does all of that unfold?
Well, the biggest problem we had was the logistics of traveling.
Yeah.
They shut down all air traffic in the United States.
Right.
And we primarily flew commercial everywhere we went. And we had, of course, once again, this was pre-TSA days,
Sure.
We just had all of our gear, and we'd load up our gear, and we had these neat little IDs that allowed us to get on any airplane. We'd walk right up to the ticket counter and say, hey, I need on this next flight, and they would bump whoever. And we took a lot of our gear with us, and it wasn't near as scrutinized as to what's in the luggage.
Right.
You know, we just packed up what we needed and left. And so I was actually in the gym when it happened. And back then, I don't know if this is going to age me quite a bit, Jeremy, but we had two-way pagers.
Oh, yeah.
And it was, you remember those, the little Motorola flip-up two-way pagers? And I was in the gym when it happened, and our gym, the way it was divided, was in between, there was a cardio room and a weight room, and there was just one little faux fence in between the two. Well, me and the meathead firefighters were in the weight side, of course, and there was a lady over on the cardio side where all the TVs were, and she hollered at us, and we walked over the her side of the fence and was looking at the TVs and watching. And at the time, we were all kind of like, you know, an accident, you know, this is crazy. And we were watching it, and we were watching the firefighters go in, and we were typical firefighter critiquing, and what would we do and how would we do it? And, you know, this is what we need to look for. And we're just kind of going over everything. And then the second plane came in.
Yeah.
And when the second plane came in, I knew right then.
Yeah.
That a lot of lives changed, including mine.
Yeah.
And my pager started going off, and, you know, get ready, you're going, and how are we going to try to get there? And so we started working through those logistics of how to get there. Once we got it all figured out, of course, we had to fly military at that point. That was the only thing allowed in the air. And we loaded up and met up and got the team together the best we could. And we all met in a warehouse in New Jersey and kind of gathered up what we could to get down to ground zero and get busy.
Man, that's incredible. When you saw that happen and you knew your life would be different, you knew things would change, what was your initial feeling? Was it, I need to get there? Was it someone needs to do something? What was your initial thought? And then you're with a bunch of firefighters. How did they respond to it?
They were all kind of the same way. We were all kind of everybody wanted to help. Every single buddy. Some of the guys with me, wanted to go with me. And my guys, I just can't load you up and take you with me. You know, I mean, we have, even though it was a lot looser protocols back then, we still had protocols. And everybody wanted to help. Everybody wanted to go. Nobody was, you know, everybody was trying to do what they could. But it was the same way. It just, the world just came together. I mean, it was amazing at how unified we were at that point.
And you actually got to ground zero on the 12th, is that right? So
yes,
20 hours, 24 hours or whatever later. At that point in your life, you weren't new to disasters like that. Obviously, you'd been to Oklahoma City, you'd seen everything that happened there and other places. When you got to ground zero, was it initial impression as you guys pulled up, was it what you thought it was going to be? Was it much worse? Talk about your initial impression when you got there.
Much worse.
The
severity of those two buildings collapsed inside of Lower Manhattan, which is crowded anyway.
Yeah.
It was surreal.
Yeah.
It was kind of like everything was more or less self-fenced off because of all the surrounding buildings. And then once you broke through a certain perimeter, it just kind of opened up into, I don't know, it'd probably be more like an arena. It had, everything was contained inside of a stadium, and everything on the outside was a fence. And once you got inside, everything was just piled up in the middle. So a little bit of severity around the edges, and but the whole disaster scene was just compact.
Yeah.
And it was just crazy.
So where do you start? You get there, you see that. There's thousands of people around. There's folks who need to be rescued. There are bodies that need to be recovered. So you have two operations going on at the same time. I'm guessing that even trying to figure out if the buildings around you are stable. Like, there's all of this happening at the same time. So you show up. Where do you start? And who tells you where to go? And how does that unfold?
FDNY was still running command and control.
Yeah.
And they would just start assigning you to sectors. And they had everything overlaid and gridded. And you would just be assigned to grids. And we kind of worked our way from the outside in the best we could.
Yeah.
For stability reasons. You don't know what's stable, what's not. Surrounding buildings were damaged for a couple of blocks.
Yeah.
And we had to be careful of how stable those buildings were, if they were in danger of collapse. And it was just the old adage of, you know, how to eat an elephant one bite at a time.
Yeah.
There weren't really two operations going like you talked about. We weren't in body recovery mode for probably a good 7-8 days.
Okay.
We stayed in rescue mode.
Yeah.
And it's a harsh reality to say, but who's dead's dead. Let's work on who we can save.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of the general civilian population probably doesn't understand that. But when you're in that mode of operation, figuratively, you just step over dead bodies to try to find live ones.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really happen at Ground Zero. We had a hard time finding dead bodies. But figuratively, you triage the situation the same way you do medical. If they're dead, there's nothing you can do for them. We'll come back to you in a little while. We're going to go try to see who we can save.
Yeah. Man, one of the most fascinating things that I've heard you talk about, and I've heard you tell the story several times, and every time it's like, it blows my mind. I have no frame of reference, really. I could go back to combat where we were moving for like days at a time, and you don't realize, like, you lose track of time and what's happening, and you're like, wow, we've been out here for like 3 days, and you know. So I've had moments like that, but you talk about kind of a, it's not a moment, but a several day period like that. Can you talk about however much of that you'd like to share where you guys were just getting after it and didn't even realize how much time had passed in the process?
Yeah, that was that 36-hour window. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
We got in and started working our way inside the rubble, and we made our way inside and was working through the debris, and we're just doing everything we could to find anybody. And we had carried these little locator beacons on us so they could kind of keep track of you. And it's pretty low tech back in the day,
right,
considering what we have now, but they were just kind of location still. And we worked our way in and had been working to find people. And as we got down and worked as far as we could, we ran out of water, ran out of food. We're really, really getting tired. And we decided that it was time to come out. And as we started coming back out, our little beacon started going off and dinging. And what it was is we had gone down and been gone so long that they had lost contact with us. And they had listed us basically missing in the rubble. And as we were working our way back out, they started going off. Well, a team came in to meet us and made sure we were okay and kind of help us get out. And we were tired, we were exhausted, but we didn't really put anything together. And they told us to report to command center. And we come out, go to corner of Church and Vestes where the command center was. We hit the command center and kind of find out we had been gone for more than 36 hours.
That's crazy. And, underground and just, for 36 underground, hours.
Just lost track of time. I mean, no daylight reference, no reference to day or night or anything, working by headlamp and flashlights and things. And we had made such good progress in there, nobody wanted to quit. And it's kind of like, because a lot of times when you go in, you'd hit dead ends. But we had worked our way all the way down into, actually made our way to the subway area.
That's crazy.
And underground, which if I recall, it was about 10 stories underground.
Wow.
And we had just lost track of time and not really, nobody was really looking at their watch. Everybody was looking for their next step. Like everything was so unstable and so rough and tumble that you didn't really pay attention to anything about your very next move. Is it going to dislodge something? And you're worried about something collapsing on in on you. So time really didn't matter. We were just doing what we had to do. And the only thing that really got to us is when we just flat ran out of water. Yep. It's like, okay, we need to go resupply.
Right.
And really didn't have any track of time.
And the people up top, I mean, they thought either you were lost or something had happened. They had no idea.
Right. Because we worked 12-hour shifts, and we would report in for briefings and debriefings. So you pretty much worked 10 hours in the pile, and an hour briefing, hour debriefing. And we didn't make our briefings or debriefings. It became a problem. But we didn't know we were a problem. We just thought we were doing our job.
That's so crazy. How long did you guys work there, your team? How long were you there?
I was there 93 days.
Yeah. Absolutely incredible.
There was a couple of breaks in there where I would get out, fly home for a couple of days, and then fly back in. We called them laundry breaks. Hmm. Thank goodness for wives back home. My ex-wife, I would pack all my dirty clothes up in a Zarges case. Anybody knows what a Zarges case is? Just a big aluminum rugged case.
Right.
And I would ship FedEx overnight, ship dirty laundry home in a Zarges case.
Yeah.
And a couple of days later, I would get it shipped back to me, clean, folded, and ready to go.
Unbelievable.
But I did get to go home for a couple of little weekend breaks.
Yeah.
And fly home. And once things kind of settled down, they didn't want you deployed for more than 2 weeks. You'd go out for 2 weeks and they'd send you home for a couple of days and then back in for 2 weeks. Back then, PTSD wasn't even on the radar. It was they knew and recognized we needed a break, but they didn't really know what we know now about everything. Yeah. And they would just send us back home for a couple of days. They'd book us a ticket and you wouldn't even get a choice. You would just show up to command and they'd say, oh, by the way, you're
going home.
You're R and out for on Friday. We'll fly you back in on Sunday. And you'd fly home Friday, spend Saturday, and then fly back in Sunday.
What was your impression being there that long of the other, whether they were teams or agencies or whatever? I mean, people from all over the country, I guess probably from all over the world responded.
Yeah.
What was your impression of the folks that were there, either working with them or observing them or, you know, whatever, as you're just kind of in this like really tight knit community, I guess, for lack of a better term?
Yeah. Other than having a weird accent, they were just one of us. I mean,
right.
There was no room for judging or profile. It was just whoever could do whatever for you.
Yeah.
And looking back on it, some of the craziest things and the stereotypical things kind of fell into place. But man, the things that we did and the people that we worked with, the cultures that intermingled, because we had people from rescue teams from all over the world showing up.
Yeah.
And usually other than just sometimes the food would be different when you got food from their table. Other than that, there was no difference. Language barrier sometimes was difficult, but everybody was there for the common goal.
Yeah.
And it was just a good overall impression. I didn't have any negative interactions with any of the other international teams at all.
Have you, over the years, have you gone back to Ground Zero, to the memorial that's there? Have you visited that?
No.
No. Yeah.
I went back on the 1 year anniversary. I went back and I haven't been back since.
Yeah. It's just too much.
Yeah. I keep saying I'm going to, and my wife keeps wanting to go back, and every year I find an excuse not to go.
Right.
But I went back on the 1 year anniversary, September 11th, participated in all the activities, and they had a big to do on the 1 year anniversary. And I went back and was part of that. But ever since then, I've just, and I probably need to face that.
Sure.
Probably some closure that I need, but nah, haven't really had any interest. The city of New York grew on me. Being a rural Texas boy stuck in New York City, I was kind of a little worried about being there, but man, the people were so great to us. Everybody was so nice. Everybody treated us so great. And I think that's probably why I don't want to go back, is I know that has since gone.
Sure.
And we've gone back to the just terrible people that we are at times, that everybody can be at times. And I don't want that impression to change. I left with a good impression of New York City and a good feeling of what we did and how we did it. And I don't know. I don't know why I'm scared to go back.
Yeah. I think it's like dealing with any traumatic event. And I mean, the trauma of that and burying it and pushing through it. Right. We talk about this a lot in our programs, and it's funny. We help other people through this, right? You've helped helped hundreds of guys walk through this, like dealing with trauma of service. And it's the same for all of us though, is at some point you do have to deal with it and kind of unpack that bag. You stuff all that stuff down in. But when you look back on that event particularly, what are your impressions, good, bad, or otherwise? I don't know, personal lessons learned, things you learned about yourself, things you wish you had done or known. What are the things you think about when you think back to that period of time?
Oh, probably one of the biggest things that I wish now that I would have known then is Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I was a believer in Jesus, but I wasn't a follower of Christ. Hmm. And that probably, if there is a regret, I guess I didn't have a full grasp on that going into it. I think I'd be a lot better off, be a better person now had I been where I'm at now then.
Yeah.
But looking back on that, man, I had to grow up fast. I was 30 years old.
Wow.
And I was a commander at the World Trade Center. I was, I was in charge at 30 years old. And I never really equated what I did to the military, because I have such a high regard for our veterans and our military service people. But I can look back now on some of the stuff I read and books I read where you have 21-year-old kids
just
in charge of these major missions in the military. And man, I was 10 years older than that. I was 30. And in military years, 30 is an old man. And I look back then at where I was at 30 years old, and I wasn't mentally prepared where I was. I've kind of coined the term of immature authority. Mm. And that's pretty much where I was at 30 years old as a commander. I was immature authority.
Yeah.
I was in charge of a lot of important things, but my mentality and my maturity level wasn't where it needed to be to do that.
Yeah. Do you think that agencies, law enforcement agencies, fire agencies, emergency response agencies are doing a better job now? And I don't mean that critically. Like, we didn't know what we didn't know, right? But have we learned lessons from events like 9/11, Oklahoma City, Katrina, these natural disasters, to better prepare our first responders to get involved in that and then come out on the other side?
I think so. I think back then we had a skewed view of what manhood was. And I think that's one of the good things that's came out of this, is there's a lot of look backs now as to how many good men we've ruined by just telling them to toughen up and, just swallow it, toughen up. And we've lost a lot of good men to suicide who didn't have the fortunate support group that we have now of understanding that, they would rather die than admit they're weak.
Yeah.
And I think we've done a lot better in the first responder community of hey, you can have a moment of weakness and still maintain your manhood.
That's good. Man, I appreciate you telling that story. I know it's got to be difficult. I've heard you talk about it. Cause we're friends, and so we've been in like social settings where I've heard you talk about this, and so it's, you know, it's different than this. But sharing it with other people is so important. Man, we can't forget these things, you know, and it's easy, as you mentioned, we kind of go back to the crazy world that we live in, and it's so important we remember, like, this was a real thing, and people came together, and as horrible as it was, there were some good things that came out of it, and
yeah,
we need to try to get back to, however we get back to that spirit of cooperation, right? I mean, it's crazy.
Some of the things that I have to do nowadays that I used to not, I used to, and I would get caught up online with some of the conspiracy theories of things, and then I would be like, you know, I was there. I can tell you that didn't happen. I physically put my hands on this, or I know what I saw. And then people would say, oh, you're just a liar. You're one of them government boots. And
sure.
I've had to learn how to just walk away from all that stuff, and just people are going to believe what they're going to believe.
Yeah.
And I saw what I saw. I know what I know.
Yeah.
And I don't have to spend all my days now trying to prove I'm right, they're wrong anymore.
Yeah, that's it, man. Well, thank you, Dusty. I appreciate you sharing that. And thank you for your service. I've heard you say many, many times, I don't want to compare what I've done to the military. I've heard you say that, and we've had conversations about that, right? But, man, your service to our country through the things that you've done and the things that you've dealt with is – I don't even know how we'd repay that. So thank you for doing it, and thank you for staying in there, man.
Man, Jeremy, thank you. I appreciate that. Like you mentioned, we're friends beyond this, and I appreciate everything you've done. You've been there for me when I've had my moments of reasoning, and I always forget one time outside of a building in California when I was going off on something, and you put everything into perspective for me in a very, very good way that I don't forget. And I appreciate you and everything you've done. And what you've done for us first responders. And, you know, I'll tell the world right now, you know, not only do we have a friendship outside of this, but, you know, Jeremy Stalnaker baptized me and turned my entire world around. And I appreciate you for what you've done.
Well, man, it's been such an enriching relationship for me. It's funny, people don't know this. And for those that aren't familiar with the work that we do at the Mighty Oaks Foundation, we work with veterans. So historically, we've worked with veterans, active duty service members. That was the Mighty Oaks Foundation. If you look that up, mightyoaksprograms.org, you'll see the work that we do. But when we started, it was veterans and active duty service members. And then I won't tell the whole story, but you came to us, right? And you're like, I can never relate to these guys, and I don't want to have anything to do with this. And man, like you confronted me on some things as it relates to even like serving people who have been through these other traumas outside of military service. And we have now, I don't know the exact number, but through the Mighty Oaks Foundation, we actively serve first responders, and we've served, you know, hundreds and hundreds. It's been over 1,000 first responders have come through our program, and you were the first one and really helped shape that. So, man, it's been a great relationship. It's been enriching on both sides, but, I just appreciate everything you've done in your professional life and what you continue to do to serve others. So thank you, man.
Jeremy, thank you. I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this. It's kind of funny sometimes now when I'm leading a program and we get some of these guys in session, and you realize you're getting old when people don't fully grasp 9/11 the way we're up there telling our story, and some of these guys – you know, we have some active duty first responders that are coming through that are 25, 26 years old that were 2-3 years old when 9/11 happened. And it's crazy how you age yourself by that. Yeah. And to me, 9/11 was just yesterday.
Yeah.
I still drive down the road. I still see pictures. And when I see a picture, I smell the picture. Mm. And, you know, I'm sure you guys in the military do see the same thing. You know exactly. You can feel the weather. You can feel the smell. Yep. You can feel the stickiness in the air. You can cough the dust. And to me, it was just last week. Yeah. And it's crazy how you age yourself when it starts to realize it. Man, that was a long time ago.
Well, that's why we need to keep telling these stories. And, you know, that's the reason for this podcast, right, is to continue to tell these stories from people who are there. And it's so important. our oral history, and you know, oftentimes is all that we have. So, man, thanks for doing it. I appreciate it.
Yep, Jeremy, thank you. I appreciate you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. If you would like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, visit ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts on the Parthenon Podcast Network. Thank you, and I will talk to you next time.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.